Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people better, the things they do and the things they say. If you'd like to learn more about this podcast, go to behavior-podcast.com. In this episode, I talk to poker player Laura Eisenberg about poker tells. We talk about a specific hand from the 2021 World Series of Poker Ladies event, an event which she won. If you'd like to watch the video of that hand, you can go to my Poker Tells Substack, which you can find by searching for Zachary Elwood Substack. I have a piece I wrote about that hand, and it includes the video. We also talk about how her thinking about poker tells has changed over the course of her poker career. We talk about some behavioral patterns she noticed in herself and stopped doing. We talk about the anxiety involved in bluffing. And we talk a little bit at the end about skydiving, which Laura has done competitively. Here's a little more about Laura. Dr. Laura Eisenberg is a WSOP bracelet and WSOP circuit ring winner who divides her time between poker and her medical career in radiology. Her largest cash was second place in the World Poker Tour Prime Event in 2022 for $481,000. Initially an avid gamer, she got interested in poker during the moneymaker boom. She credits her coach, John Von Fleet, also known as Ape Styles, and BBZ Poker for helping take her game to the level needed to win a bracelet. A prior competitive billiards player and skydiver, she holds two skydiving world records, including the current 400-person world record in formation skydiving set in Thailand in 2006. Outside of poker strategy, she has a special interest in mindset and lifestyle optimization for success in poker and other endeavors. She serves on the Board of Trustees for Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, and lives in Silver Spring, Maryland with her wife. Okay, here's the talk with Laura Eisenberg. Hi, Laura. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for having me, Zach.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Maybe we can start with, how would you rate your skills at reading tells? How often would you say you change a decision based on a read?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I'm never arrogant enough to think that, I'm some sort of a, live tells expert or anything like that. But I think it varies just an absolute ton. You know, there's tables that I find myself at where people are just leaking a lot of information and they're much easier to read in general. And usually those are lower buy-in kind of situations. And then there's tables that you're at usually with better players where it's just, there's just not a lot of information. Mm-hmm. But sometimes mm-hmm. there can be as well if people have been playing online and they're not as careful. And so it's really varied a lot. I think people still give away a lot of pre-flop information. And I think people are becoming more aware of like the more common tells, post-flop and like obvious things, and strong is weak, weak is strong. But it's still very hard for people to resist human instinct kind of things. Mm-hmm. So, I think I'm probably above average, but I'm certainly, not some white magic person.
Do you play both cash games and tournaments?
I very rarely play cash. I'm almost always an exclusive tournament player, and that definitely affects things as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of things do come down to, I think in cash games, people are more likely to be relaxed, mm-hmm. Unless they're playing way over their head. They may be letting their guard down a little bit more than people who are going to get bounced out of the tournament if they mess up. So,
right. Yeah. It seems like, it's two different, kind of really two different environments. It's like mm-hmm. the cash games are really relaxed and people, you're more likely to get like verbal stuff and things like this. And in tournaments, they're much more locked down and more stoic and, take it much more seriously. But then again, you're more likely to get like the really high intensity tells maybe at the end when the stakes are really high. Yeah. Different beasts basically.
Totally agree.
Maybe we could talk about how you're thoughts on poker tells have changed over time. Did you used to think they were more or less valuable than you do now? And how did that thinking progress for you?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I've now been in this, I guess, kind of a long time because I started back in the moneymaker days, not knowing anything at all about poker when I first started playing. I think you have this notion that, like, you know, oh, you know, people are going to be breaking their Oreo cookie this way or that way, or, you know, there's going to be all of these, you know, so much of it must be tells and you got to have a poker face, you know, and then you fairly quickly realize that, okay, that's not really how it works. But then I was so focused for so long on strategy that it felt like putting a lot of emphasis on trying to do tells, that was just like more than I was going to be able to process even at the table. And so I would say it wasn't until I started delving into your stuff initially that I started really understanding what to look for, and immediately realizing things in myself that's like, oh, wow, okay, I do that, I do that, I do that. You know, and you're like, okay, let's stop doing those things at least at first. And I think that controlling your own tells and your own leakage of information is really the place to start. And then I really, your video series I thought was excellent in, you know, it's because it's one thing to read about tells, and I think your books have been amazing, but to see in the video series examples of these things in action, that really helps to hammer it home to me. You know, that helped me have a more structured approach as to what I'm looking for. I think like Eastman's material in Beyond Tells is also helpful and, you know, and somewhat exploitive, which is less, you're less able to do that kind of thing in tournaments because usually they won't allow you to be trying to, you know, verbally talk about your hand or do other things like that so much. And you don't want to end up with penalties. But certainly there have been people that have pushed that envelope about as far as you can too. But
well, yeah, thanks for the kind words on that. And when you talked about the moments when you realized, oh, I'm giving away something that I didn't know I was giving away, Is there something that comes to mind for that? Were there some specific learning moments that you remember about that behavior?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I do think that it doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't always successful. But I think, you know, when you don't know anything, you're definitely doing some of the strong is weak, weak is strong kind of stuff and trying to appear cavalier when you have, you know, or nervous at time, you know, and just trying to manipulate people that way. And then also just the timing tells around looking at a hand and seeing top of range, you know, and doing, you know, and putting the cards down right away, that kind of stuff. You know, I definitely saw as I started thinking about that in myself that I did the same thing because it's actually very instinctual to look, see aces, put it down. Number one, it's the, you know, protecting your treasure kind of stuff people talk about, but also you don't have anything to think about. You know exactly what you're going to do. So, and, you know, boom. And then touching your chips and things like that instinctively and like are trying to discourage somebody from betting, you know, those kind of things I saw myself doing from time to time. And I don't do that, any of that stuff now, but you know, there were a number of things where you're just sort of like, wow, I think I've done this and that from time to time.
Yeah. Those are some good examples. Yeah. Maybe we could talk about the hand that you sent me from the World Series of Poker ladies event, which was the 2021 ladies event. Could you walk us through that hand and what your decision points were like and how the behavior came into play?
Yeah, absolutely. It was for me my first live streamed final table, and we were down to six of us left, two big stacks and four very similar sized stacks of about 22 to 24 big blinds. I think we maybe were all about 24 big blinds, and folded to me on the button. And I had pocket eights and raised. And JJ Liu, who's a very strong and aggressive player in the small blind, immediately raised and relatively small size, which she would do probably with anything that she was going to raise sizing wise, but perhaps not. Perhaps she would raise larger with hands that she'd like to get a fold with. But so it folded back to me and a decision point. And my at the time, I kind of thought, like, I think that eights is just a fold anyway, in retrospect. But at the time, against a very aggressive player, I debated whether or not I should see a flop, you know, whether I should just jam and run it.
And that's a spot where for non-poker playing audiences, you know, because she was an aggressive player, that's a spot where you raised from late position the button, the very last position besides the blinds, and she was three betting you, which you know, some people would say like maybe she was, you know, thinking that you were just raising because of your position, you know. And so that just to say for non-poker playing audiences, it could be a spot where people would try to bluff you and want you to fold because they think you yourself are often raising without much, basically.
Exactly. So, I mean, and so she should have a non-all-in. I mean, she should have a jamming range and things like ace-king, you know, and maybe ace-queen should be in a three-bet jamming range. You know, but then she should have a three-betting non-all-in range with top of range and then some bluffs like maybe, you know, bad offsuit aces and some things like that, or even medium ones. But, you know, at the time, I perceived that she three-bet me, number one, very quickly. I had my raise out there and she immediately three bet. You know, when I actually later reviewed the footage of that, she had looked at her hand long before. So it wasn't that she checked her hand and then immediately three bet me. Mm-hmm. She already knew what her hand was. So she knew she was going to three bet once I raised. So that was not necessarily, I think I interpreted that in a way that maybe in retrospect is not correct.
Although there is something interesting there because it's like, it's still, she would still know that it can be perceived as strange, right? So it's like kind of a willingness to do something a little unusual, you know, the immediate thing. Even, you know, a lot of people would be like, oh, I got to wait my standard, you know, 2 seconds or whatever.
Right. And she did fumble like around with chips. Some like it's almost like she knew she was going to three bet, but then it was like what combination of chips she was going to use to put it out. But I didn't make a whole lot of that at the time. But what I did notice right away, and I texted you about afterwards, is that after she three bet me, she fairly quickly started flipping a chip. And she flipped it a couple of times because, you know, I had just been thinking about what to do and whether to fold. And then I saw that and I looked because I was like, did I see that correctly? And then she had stopped doing it. And I started flipping a chip myself to see if she would start doing it again. Because I remembered that from your video course. And then she did start flipping it again, you know, and I thought, she probably very relaxed here. And I think I probably would have folded anyway, had I, you know, just thinking it through regardless of that. Mm-hmm. But once I saw and then confirmed that, then I just folded and moved
makes
on
it,
from there.
Makes it less of a decision. Yeah,
exactly.
And she was pretty aggressive. So, you know, I can see if you thought she was often, if you knew that she was often raising, I can see how that would become a tougher, you know, tough to
right. say. But then you also say, well, we're on a televised final table. It's the first hand.
First hand,
like,
right.
How often is this a bluff where you're just going to like play one hand and like you're gone? Like that just makes it also so much less likely. I mean, there are all these other things pointing to a fold. So it's not like, oh, I'm some genius and I was going to, you know, it's an obvious call, but the, you know, that's what made me fold. It's just like so often is the case. It's one more thing when you're on, if you feel on the border or something like that, that can make you more confident one way or the other, as you've emphasized so often in your books.
Right. There's so many of these borderline spots where, you know, maybe not necessarily this one for you but other people often encounter or we all often encounter those borderline spots, and having something to make you sway you one way or the other is hugely important. Yeah. But to your point about it being, yeah, the first hand of the final table. And I'd written about it in that, on the blog post, I think I put it on the Substack newsletter. But yeah, the fact that the immediate bet, you know, the immediate raise, and also the like kind of like you were describing the back and forth kind of chip gathering all struck me as very relaxed. And in the context, especially of this, the first hand of the tournament, you know, where all eyes are on you and you think you might, you know, might be a little bit more stoic or at least to start the game, it makes it even more likely, I think, that someone showing these signs of relaxation. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the and to describe it more for non poker playing audiences, the chip flipping is kind of this end over end chip flipping. We're not talking about the
not shuffling,
you know, the shuffling of chips, you know, stacks of chip. We're just talking about flipping one chip end over end, and that some people, I think Joe Navarro and other people have called that kind of behavior like gravity defying. It's kind of an upward and very loose and upward movement kind of movements. But I think it, you know, that kind of thing can give away that someone's in a lighter mood, basically a bit more relaxed. And that especially, like, it's kind of amazing how few times I've seen that from bluffers. Like it's gotta be, I mean, I could probably review my spreadsheet notes, but it's a hugely reliable tell and surprisingly reliable, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Oh, did we say what she had? She did have aces, right?
Yeah, aces. Yeah.
I don't know if we mentioned that or if we were building up to it. I can't remember. A quick note, if you'd like to read the piece I wrote about this hand or see the video, search for Zachary Elwood Substack and you should find it. Back to the talk. Yeah, anything else strike you from that hand that was interesting? I was curious if you went back and reviewed the footage and saw, you know, anything else interesting from her, like that was related to that read or anything.
I think that was mainly the thing. It was that, you know, I remember at the time thinking, I mean, the chip flipping kind of cinched it for me, but also I had thought the speed of the three bet, but then looking back at that in retrospect, that was definitely more of, I thought she checked her hand and then immediately three bet, then that wasn't the sequence at all. You know, and I think sometimes you just, you know, you get in the moment and then are thinking back through things, maybe don't remember it 100% accurately either. Mm-hmm.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Well, yeah, and I had noticed that too. Yeah, she had looked very early, which is also an interesting thing too, to notice about your opponents. It's like, are they looking early or are they looking when the action's on them? Because if somebody's looking early, obviously you're going to, there's more value to kind of like keeping an eye on them when they're behind you and seeing if you've got any clues, like, are they paying attention or not paying attention? So not to say there's anything wrong with looking at your hand early, because I look at my hand early, but it just means you theoretically might be able to get something on the earlier side. Yeah.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. You had joked about when we put this out or the Substack piece and this, you have to worry about people faking you out with,
everyone's going to be chip flipping forever, right?
Yeah, when they bluff, you know, you have to keep in mind, like, how much do they pay attention to the poker stuff?
Yeah, right, 100%.
Let's see, any other interesting hands from your poker career stand out where a behavior played a big role, a tell played a big role?
Well, you know, I mean, I've seen a lot of really crazy stuff. A lot of it comes up at the World Series, but I have seen people who will look at their hand and the number of chips that they'll put on top of their cards is directly proportional to the strength of their hand. I have seen people who will check their cards and they don't put a chip on it if they're folding, and they put it in the middle of the cards if they're definitely playing the hand, and mm-hmm. they'll put it on the edge of the cards if they're not sure and they're going to see depending on the action. I mean, you can just like raise across the table, you know, from under the gun, if that person's in the blinds when they don't have the chip. Yeah, like it's just like really reliable when people do some of these things. I mean, and that's why I don't like use a card protector or do anything like that. I think it's best to certainly have a very structured pre-flop routine. And like you, I check my cards early as well. That way, I'm less likely to be giving away information, I think, as far as looking at my cards and then having people all be able to watch reactions, et cetera. But then you have to still pay attention to the action when you're not going to play the hand.
Yeah. You had mentioned earlier the pre-flop kind of tells, those early tells. I think those are so much more valuable and have contained so much more information than most people tend to know, because like you're saying, there's all these little patterns that can come out, you know, including like, you know, the way somebody might place a chip protector on their cards. Like if they put it down with a good amount of force, you know, that the fact that they're willing to draw attention to themselves when they haven't yet acted.
Yep.
It oftentimes shows that they're not at the top of their range because they're
cavalier movements.
Yeah. They're like these small little things, you know, like if they had aces, they would be much more like slow and stoic and not moving around much to draw attention to themselves and these kind of things. Mm-hmm. So it's like sometimes, you know, like a good example, an extreme example of this is somebody to my left, like looks at their cards and they kind of like slaps their chip protector down with a heavy slap. I'm like, yeah, I don't think they have much, basically.
Not top
yeah.
of range.
So, I mean, yeah. There's all these little clues that are reasons to, you know, at the very least, watch the people directly behind you for these little clues. You know, it could be the difference between, you know, deciding to three bet them or you know, three bet them light or see a flop with them or whatever it may be, you know.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, and there's definitely people who are, the way that they place the chips out is very different with different type parts of their range as well. Mm-hmm. So that can certainly be very helpful.
We kind of wrapped up the tell stuff. Do you want to do a brief summary of how you got into poker and what makes you so passionate about it?
Sure. I used to be a computer gamer, you know, PC gamer, and, you know, had the whole fancy computer set up and all that for games, and was watching commercials after the news one night after dinner and saw something for Poker Stars or whatever talking about, you know, play poker on the internet. I was like, what? You can play poker for money on the internet. Is that like even legal? That seems crazy. And I couldn't believe it. And I was like, well, all right, I'll learn how to play whatever this game is, because, you know, it's kind of dumb to play games for free when I could be playing games for money. And started picking up books and reading, and I didn't know anything at all about like what beats what or any of it. So just started from scratch and started playing, you know, cash games and limit and eventually no limit and eventually tournaments, and kind of built from there. And my game really took off when I started getting coaching from Ape Styles. And now he's moved over to BBZ, and so I'm learning a lot from all the different coaches over there. And that's just really catapulted my learning from there. So
it sounds like you like games in general. When you decided to try poker out, sounds like it was mainly a practical decision. But how quickly did you enjoy the game? Did you immediately think like, this is a fascinating game, or did that take a while?
I loved it right away, but I mean, I was so clueless, you know, that like, I didn't know anything about strategy, but you're just like, well, that's a flop that has like two of one kind on it. So it's less likely that he's got one of those, or like now the turn paired. So like probably nobody has anything, you know, maybe I should raise, like, I don't know, you know, and just sort of like instinct. Making it up as you go. Cause like, I didn't know anything. And then it's like just like so awful. But yeah, no, I really loved the game right from the beginning. But I was, you know, busy. I worked full time and I was a competitive skydiver at the time that I got into poker. So I definitely wasn't devoting like, you know, all my free time to it or anything like that. It just sort of grew over the years. And then once I quit skydiving, then I started devoting more time to poker.
So. Well, skydiving, that's a interesting aspect. I would think you must be, that must give you some good nerves.
Yeah, I think it's helpful in that way. You know, I don't think I get super nervous at the table. It's like, at least they're not life and death decisions. So there's that. And medicine, you know, puts you in some pretty tough situations as well. That helps. But I think honestly, like a lot of what helps to not be nervous in poker in big spots is just volume.
Just the experience.
Yeah, the more you've played online and you've just, you know, been one-outered a bunch of different times. Like the things just become less shocking and, you know, you become less sad when things, suckouts happen and things like that. So it's like, well, it's all happened a bunch. And so it doesn't seem that nuts, you know. And,
more alligator blood.
Yeah. And in the beginning, you just are like, you're an 80% favorite. And so in your mind, that's 100%. And so if anything else happens, you know, you're like bonkers. So, you know, you just have to really like learn how reality works. And that's helpful. What I love about poker is that there's so many things that you learn that are translatable to real life and to, you know, non-poker life, and being able to, you know, kind of live with more equanimity in lots of areas of your life.
Do you still get in, say you're in a big tournament in a towards the end, final table or whatever, do you still get the blood pumping when you make a big bluff?
Yeah, but I mean, as much, it's, you know, making a big bluff or just being in a big spot or, you know, being all in for a six-figure difference.
Right.
And it's like, wow, we're like flipping, you know, this past December, you know, we're like, we're flipping, it's a coin flip, you know, for 150K. You know, like, yeah, that seems crazy.
That's a weird, when you think about it, yeah. It's like, what are we doing? This is crazy.
Yeah. it's pretty nuts stuff. But yeah, it's, I think I get less, I definitely don't get super nervous bluffing as much anymore, in that if I know that it's the right thing to do, then it's not, you know, it's less of a feeling that you're getting away with something. I think part of what would make me feel nervous bluffing in the beginning is that you feel like you're trying to convince somebody of something, or you're trying to get away with something. Mm-hmm. And you're really not. You're just playing good poker, you know, and every mm-hmm. time you make a big bet, you should have a mixture of hands. And that's that, you know, and
right,
you know, when
right.
you do have it or you don't have it, like whatever, you've made the correct decision already, then they're just going to make theirs. And then trying to think about it in that way, you know, you're part of that story is already written. It's done. The only time it's bad is when you like are sitting there and you're like, you know what? I actually really don't like this bluff. My blocker sucks or like whatever it is. And you're like, this is kind of stupid, you know? And then you're just sitting there like, well, it's already done. But you're like, I think this isn't the right combo, but you know,
there's the guilty feeling that, you know, you can get over pretty quickly in your career. But then there's also the fear that like, are they going to pick something up? Even if, you know, you don't feel particularly anxious, it's like, are they going to read something even wrongly on me that's going to make them call, you know? There's kind mm-hmm. of like, there's a little bit of that anxiety too, which is like another level of anxiety, at least for me, like that plays a role. But I was going to ask you about the, since we got on the subject of the skydiving, cause I've gone skydiving once. Mm-hmm. I was curious how many times can you, do you have to do it before you go on your own, or how did that work for you?
So I started back when I was a surgery resident. I started out in surgery and then switched to radiology. I was in a thing where I did, I think it was 10 jumps before you were on your own. Mm. And five of them or six of them were tandems. And then five of them, you had your own gear, but you were with one person, you know, so they were like there in case of an emergency. Mm. But then you were on radio with them helping you to fly your parachute and land. Mm. And then they had like 10 jumps that you could do optionally with a coach to just like work on things, you know. But then it takes hundreds of jumps after that to really become safe and competent, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yeah. When you do so if you're going out there as a beginner with the tandem jumps or whatever, are the people watching you just making sure like that they'll wait to pull their parachute until you pull yours kind of thing and make sure you pulled it and then they pull theirs?
You mean after the tandem?
Or yeah, I guess when you're on your own, but still doing it with right. people that might be watching you.
Yeah. Well, the way that the drop zone I learned from did it is that they would have you, for those five jumps after, they would have you progressively doing more skills, you know? And so you had to like fly forwards and backwards to them. And then you had to like do a 360 in place. And, you know, you had to do a couple of it. Like, so it was like learning how to fly and maneuvers.
I see.
But they're also there if you have, in case something comes up, you know, you get over on your back and you like start spinning or do something dumb.
I said tandem, but tandem is when you're connected to them, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so for the tandems, they actually did a pretty good job of trying to teach you some basics of flying during the tandems. And it wasn't just like going for a ride six times in a row. But yeah, that was it. So I made 4,500 or so jumps before I quit, which is a pretty strong bunch of time.
Did you ever have a terrifying moment?
Yeah, I had some close call incidents. The biggest one was I was on a large formation. We had like a 100-person formation. So we had several planes, and there were two of us that were the last ones out of this plane called a Skyvan, which is not a super stable plane. And you try to get a whole bunch of people all in the back to jump out at the same time so that everybody can exit really quickly. And a new pilot. And long story short, he ended up stalling the plane. And so the two of us that were last out got thrown up into the air and then out the back. And I ended up hitting my head on the way past the ramp and knocked out. And you have an automatic opener, but I was unconscious for probably 20 seconds until I woke up and was trying to figure out what was going on. And then I was able to fly away and like open my parachute and land and stuff and just had like a lacerated head. Jeez. But that was pretty crazy.
So they have automatic openers on them.
Yeah. It's optional, but most people buy an automatic opener so that it detects your velocity and your altitude. So if you go through a certain altitude window at too high a rate of speed, it automatically opens your reserve.
So, oh, I did not know that. Yeah. That makes sense, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't guarantee that your reserve will open safely. They normally do. It doesn't guarantee that whatever injury knocked you out isn't going to kill you anyway. But and it doesn't guarantee that you'll land safely under this reserve while you're unconscious. But it's, you know, lots and lots of people have been saved by automatic activation devices or AADs.
So, well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Because I'm not surprised they would have some way to have figured out some way by now to help with that. So
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Huh. That makes me interested in trying it again then. Cause that was always one of my fears. So I'm like, what if something goes wrong? You know, but that would make me feel a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah. The tandems all have automatic openers, but normally the issues that come up with tandems aren't like getting knocked unconscious. Cause you're just the two of you there, but in case something happened and like your instructor had a heart attack and passed out, you're not just the total victim. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
all right. This has been great, Laura. Yeah. Thanks for coming on and sharing your story and talking about it.
Well, it's really fun. I've always appreciated your work. It certainly helped me. And it's really nice to get to meet and chat with you.
That was a talk with poker player Laura Eisenberg. If you'd like to learn more about my PokerTales work, go to readingpokertales.com. If you enjoyed this talk, I have several other episodes I've done on the topic of PokerTales. To find those, you can go to my site, behavior-podcast.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
True or false? Walmart has eye care. True. Stop by Walmart to save and browse top designer frames right where you already shop. And they accept most insurance. Welcome to Easy Eye Care. Welcome to your Walmart.
Here you are. BPM's high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too.
Aw.
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.